from KMOX Sports.
Okay, boys, here we go.
Welcome to the Graybar Sports Open Line.
Those bit swings, and he hits a drive. He hits a slammer.
Graybar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs.
Here we go.
Now, Matt Pauly on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
All right, man, let's get going here.
Here we go. Let's go.
On Tuesday, we've arrived. It's time for a Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name's Matt Pauly, taking you for the next 2 hours. We are with you until 8 o'clock this evening. And then at 8 o'clock, it is the Gas House Gang, which tonight is going to feature Tom Ackerman and Kevin Wheeler. In my 2 hours with you, we've got a lot to get to. It's actually been kind of a busy sports news day. Here in the first hour, we're really going to focus in on, from a baseball standpoint, the players the Cardinals choose to protect on their 40-man roster, making them ineligible to be picked up in the Rule 5 draft by other organizations. Well, also, the breaking news of the moment is that Cleveland manager Stephen Vogt and Milwaukee manager Pat Murphy have been named the respective managers of the year. That news is coming down over the last half hour or so. So we'll get into that. And then hockey-wise, we got to talk through the big news today that Robert Thomas is back. What an incredible timeline for him to be able to return. When he got injured, the thought was that he was going to probably miss... They said 4 to 6 weeks. That was what the Blues said, but other experts out there were saying 6 to 8 weeks. It felt like there was a good chance that this was going to be a two-month kind of injury with his ankle, and just short of 1 month and only 12 games missed, he's back tonight. He's back, and hopefully this gives the Blues the kind of bump that we are looking for them to have. He is back. You know, just with him back in the lineup, everything just kind of looks better. You know, all of a sudden that top line with Thomas, Buchnevich, and Kyrou, you feel like that's a dangerous line. That second line with Shin, Sod, and Neighbors, you feel good about that. All of a sudden, you know, Dylan Holloway is your third line center. That's respectable. Like, it just, everything else kind of falls into place. It's incredible and amazing how one player can impact so many things. I feel so much better about just looking at this Blues team with Thomas in the lineup as opposed to him not being there. So that's great news. Kapanen was put on waivers. He's been picked up, so he's no longer in the organization. That's the cost of these type of things. And bluntly and honestly, when you've had the start to the season the Blues have had, and when you've had not even the record standpoint, I'm still not bothered by the record. I'm more bothered by some of the individual game performances that we've talked about and some things that have happened. At some point, it needs to be more than just guys not suiting up one night. It needs to be more than that. And Kasperi Kapanen's the first kind of casualty of all that. It's connected to needing his roster spot. But it doesn't bother me at all that they move on from him. And I don't know. We'll see what happens here moving forward. Again, you really hope that this team get some sort of a emotional bump from that. We'll hear from Drew Bannister. We'll hear from Robert Thomas coming up later on this hour. As always, if you want to chime in, texting, tweeting, the best way to do it, 314-436-7900. 314-436-7900. That's how you call. That's how you text. If you tweet at me, at Matt Pauly on air, MattPauley on air. So let's get to the Cardinals news of the day, though. And that is the players that they elect to protect by placing them onto the 40-man roster. And with that, they can now not be selected in the upcoming Rule 5 draft. Two of these names were absolute no-brainers. We knew from the moment that the season came to an end and that there were guys that they were going to have to protect, we always knew that pitcher Tink Hintz and pitcher Tekoa Roby were going to be on this list. Very clear, obviously, two of the top pitching prospects in the organization, Quinn Matthews being the other, but Hintz and Roby, you can easily make the argument that they, along with Matthews, are the top three pitching prospects in the organization. And the good news when it comes to that is we will probably see all three of those guys in the big leagues at some point this upcoming season. I guess Roby would be the one that maybe there's a little bit of a question on, but I think in all likelihood Roby gets there this year. Certainly Hintz does. You got to get Hintz to the big leagues this year somehow, some way. Probably as a reliever. That's kind of what I think it's going to turn into, but I could be wrong on that. Maybe they do get him up as a starter. And obviously, Quinn Matthews is going to be in that starting rotation before we know it. So that's good news for the in a year where you're going through a reset, in a year where you're handing things off to younger players, it's a very good thing that some of your top prospects from a pitching standpoint are ready to graduate to the big leagues. And those guys are just about there. The other two, one of them is a pitcher in Matt Swanson. And I'm fine with that. Like Swanson, he was acquired in the Paul DeJong trade when he went to the Toronto Blue Jays. He's someone that profiles out as, at least for his next step, he's somebody who profiles out that they're going to have a need for a relief pitcher at some point in the season, and he's going to be pitching well at Memphis, and he's going to get that opportunity. You know, the way it went down this past year with a Chris Roycroft or a Ryan Lewis, like those kind of guys. That next guy at Memphis who's going to be in the bullpen, Kyle Leahy. And I think he has more upside than some of these names that I'm mentioning right now. But that's sort of, I don't think Swanson's going to make the club out of spring training, but I think he's going to be ready to help this club at some point during the year. And then outfielder Matt Kupierniak, which Kevin Wheeler and I talked about this a little bit when we did sports at 5:15 during Total Information PM. You have to have guys at AAA who, if you call them up to the big leagues, they're not going to embarrass themselves. That they're going to go out and they're going to, you know, play a position well. They're going to give you, they're going to compete in at bats, that they can sit on the bench for a few days and they can, you know, come up for a pinch hit or come up for a late appearance at the plate, and they're not going to embarrass themselves. Like that, to me, that's kind of what Matt Kupierniak has turned himself into. And Kupierniak is a fantastic story. Undrafted free agent, played college at a D3 school in Connecticut, and never really had prospect status, but slowly but surely, he's been able to turn himself into something where all of a sudden now, when the Cardinals have to make a decision on him as to whether or not he's going to, whether or not they're going to let him be exposed, that they keep him. Was born in the United Kingdom, played for Great Britain in the 2023 World Baseball Classic. So good story there. And since his beginning his professional baseball career in 2021, he leads all minor league baseball players with a .298 career batting average, and he led the International League with 143 hits in 2024 when playing for Memphis. So this is just a really good story. This is just a fantastic story of a guy who has been able to turn himself into something. Again, undrafted out of a D3 school, born in the United Kingdom. Like that doesn't say big time prospect over it. And again, he never had prospect status, but he is somebody that, you know, high prospect status. He's somebody who's been able to put himself in this position. So we'll likely see, and we've seen him in spring training the last couple of years. He, again, a guy who's not going to embarrass himself. If Lars Nootbaar goes down to injury, and we've seen that before, and all of a sudden you need to throw somebody out in left field 3-4 times a week, Kupierniak is somebody who could certainly fill that role. Now, not everybody who needed to be protected to not be eligible for the Rule 5 draft were protected. I think most notably, Ian Bedell was not. He's a pitcher. He's a Mizzou guy. To me, it probably came down. I don't know what the thinking was behind closed doors, but in all likelihood, the thinking probably came down either Swanson or Bedell was going to be one of those two guys, and they end up going with Swanson. Trent Baker, Alex Cornwell, Andre Granillo, among other players who could have been protected and were not, and we'll see if any of them end up being selected in the Rule 5 draft. I could see a team picking up an Ian Bedell in the Rule 5 draft and seeing if he might fit as somebody who can be at the backside of the bullpen. So there will be some intrigue to the Rule 5 draft this year on if any Cardinals players are going to get selected by another organization. Also, the other small move that was made in all of this, Drew Rahm, who was injured pretty much all of this past season, was on the 40-man roster. he was able to clear waivers and he accepts the assignment, or he's reassigned. He stays in the organization is the better way to say that. He's now just a minor league player in the organization, being outrighted to AAA Memphis. So any team could have picked him up if they were willing to put him on the 40-man roster. No team was willing to do that. He had some good moments a couple years ago. He had that one start that was really, really good. And he was around all year long going through the rehab process. We saw him in the Cardinals clubhouse just about every day, but really didn't get to pitch because of injury. And now he is going to have to earn his spot back again. He's going to have to perform well to get back on the 40-man roster and also perform well enough to get back onto the big league roster as well. So those are kind of the moves of the day. If you've got any thoughts on them, feel free to share them. You can text in at 314-436-7900. You can tweet at me at Matt Pauley on air. M-A-T-T-P-A-U-L-E-Y on air. When we come back, we're going to get into the news of the last hour or so. The managers of the year being announced both in the American League and the National League. And the guy from the National League comes from the NL Central. We'll get into that in just a moment. This is a Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. It's Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauley. Great to be with you tonight. We'll talk some Blues hockey coming up in our next segment. We'll hear from both Drew Bannister and Robert Thomas as the Blues are in action tonight against the Wild. And what do you know? We are going to see Robert Thomas on the ice, which is pretty crazy. And good on him, man. That says a lot about him and how hard he worked to get back. So a lot of credit goes to Robert Thomas for getting himself in position to be able to return so soon. A little more baseball talk, though, before we shift over to hockey. Went through the moves that the Cardinals made earlier today for the 40-man roster. Also today, it has been announced that the winners of the respective Manager of the Year awards, the Cleveland Guardians' Stephen Vogt, being named on the American League side of things, and then Pat Murphy from the Milwaukee Brewers being named the National League Manager of the Year. I didn't think Murph was going to win it. Because you look at what happened in New York with the Mets and the run that they went on, and I am a believer that there are coastal biases out there. So as good of a job that Pat Murphy did in Milwaukee, I thought that it was going to end up being Mendoza. I was wrong on that. Not only does Murphy win, he wins in an absolute landslide as he gets 27 of the first place votes. The only other managers who got any first-place votes, Mike Schilt from San Diego got one of them, Carlos Mendoza got one of them, and then Rob Thompson in Philadelphia got one of them, which is a weird one. By the way, Oliver Marmol received a vote. I haven't seen they do release. We'll see if we can figure this out in a second. Oliver Marmol received one third-place vote for the National League Manager of the Year award. And again, I'm of the belief that he did a very good job on it. So very good job this season. And I don't know if I would have put him on my list to do that. Okay, so here's the, we can tell you who it is. I'll look this up. So Oliver Marmol, where are you for a third place vote? Not trying to call. Okay. Oh, Keith Law. That's funny. A guy, that's perfect. That is so perfect because Cardinals fans hate Keith Law. They hate him. They hate Keith. Keith Law is like enemy number one of Cardinals fans sometimes, going back to things that he had said previously. And he had some, I think he didn't vote Adam Wainwright maybe as a Cy Young. Like he cost Adam Wainwright a Cy Young award one year, something like that. I'm trying to remember this. I wasn't living here at the time. And then he went on to like try to defend it on one of the local radio stations. I don't know where he went, and he said some things and everybody got upset. So it is just, it is perfect. It is a chef's kiss that Keith Law, somebody who many Cardinals fans have disdain for, would vote Oliver Marmol for the one vote because of just the way many Cardinal fans feel about Marmol. I'm fine with that. I think Marmol did a fantastic job this year with the Cardinals, all things considered. And again, you look at Bernie McLis brings this up all the time. You look at the run differential and what the Cardinals' record should have been based off run differential alone. And, you know, they should have been like a 69-win team, and they ended up being above 500. So, interesting. Keith Law had an interesting ballot. So he did go Pat Murphy number one, but then he went Arizona's Torrey Lovello number two. I don't think he did a very good job this year in Arizona. And then he went Marmol number three. So Pat Murphy wins it. Mike Schilt comes in second. He got 70 total points to Murphy's 144. Schilt gets 19 second place votes. Carlos Mendoza does come in third with 35. I'm shocked that he did not get more. Then Torrey Lovello came in number four. Rob Thompson, Brian Snitker, Dave Roberts, and Oliver Marmol round things out. So Marmol gets just the one vote and the 1 point there. So, there you go. Oliver Marmol comes in. We can always say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Forever and ever, we can say Oliver Marmol was the 8th place finisher in the 2024 National League Manager of the Year race. I do laugh. I laugh a lot, actually. And this, you know, I had a front row seat to this because of all my years covering the Brewers in Milwaukee. I think the world of Craig Counsell. I think Craig Counsell is a fantastic manager. I don't really know what happened in Chicago this year, but I think he's a really good manager. So he never won Manager of the Year award in Milwaukee. And you think about those really good teams. You know, the Brewers have been the team that's kind of been in control of this division for a while. They had a team that won the Central and got to the NLCS, losing in seven games to the Dodgers. What was that, 2017, 2018, whenever that was. So, I mean, they've had some really, really good teams. And admittedly, postseason success is not part of this award. They're voted on before the postseason. But I think it's really funny that you think about how much success the Brewers have had in recent years and how much of that success was connected to their manager, Craig Counsell. Counsell received so much credit for the job he did, and he never once won National League Manager of the Year. And then Pat Murphy, in his first year running that team, he ends up winning the Manager of the Year award. So, congratulations to him. I did think it was interesting today, by the way. And again, we watch the Brewers and what they do every year, and we're going to play the same game. We're going to do the, and I'm going to be as guilty as anybody. We're going to be coming into the season next year, and people are going to be making their picks for who's going to win the division and who's going to do this and who's going to do that. And what are we going to do? We're going to discount Milwaukee. We are, even though we see it year after year after year, we are going to sit here and we are going to discount Milwaukee. And then if they just keep doing what they've been doing, they're going to go have a successful season. That being said, one of the things that I talk about, and we had this discussion the other day, was it yesterday? We had this discussion the other day on the Gas House Gang about, you know, things that the Brewers do that the Cardinals could emulate and do better. And I think one of the things that the Brewers are really good at, it's allowing players to become the best version of themselves. It's always putting players in the best position to be successful. And today, they had a kind of a funky position on their staff. On the coaching staff, they had a guy who was the Brewers run prevention coordinator. Like, that's not really a title that you normally hear. You hear about hitting coaches and pitching coaches and bench coaches and things like that. But the Brewers on their staff had this guy who his title was a run prevention coordinator. Super smart dude. They leaned on him a lot on some, you know, strategy things and items like that. Well, he is leaving Milwaukee. He is going to the White Sox to become their new bench coach. The guy's name is Walker McKinven. So he is out of there. So that's just, but that's what happens. And some other, so Quinton Berry was their first base coach who really works well with like he does a lot of the base running coaching. He left to go to Chicago. He joined Craig Counsell in Chicago this year. So the Brewers lose people all the time. Every year they lose people. They lose really, really good people who are really, really good at their jobs. And then they just replace him. David Stearns leaves. Matt Arnold does a great job. Craig Counsell leaves. Pat Murphy does a great job. Players, Devin Williams gets injured. Some dude that you've never heard of steps into the closer's role for the vast majority of the season, and he does a great job. Like the plug-and-play nature of what they do in Milwaukee is ridiculous. And they're going to trade away Devin Williams this offseason. I would think there's a chance some other guys get moved as well. We'll have to wait and see. We're going to get to the start of next year. People are going to be discounting them, including myself. I know what I'm going to do, and I can't stop myself. People are going to be discounting them, and then we're going to get into the season, and we'll see if they just do the same thing that they always do. But in all seriousness, congratulations to Pat Murphy for winning that award. I think it was well-deserved for what he was able to do there. And it would be really, really good if this time next year we're talking about a Cardinals team that overachieves in a big, big way with a bunch of young players, and we're legitimately talking about Oliver Marmol and being one of the finalists for this job. And I think the Cardinals are kind of setting up to, if they play above their skis, they're setting up for that. Because who wins Manager of the Year? Manager of the Year goes to either the team that starts horribly and just turns it on in the second half and has this remarkable comeback, or the Manager of the Year award goes to a team that exceeds expectations by just a ton. Every once in a while, you'll get like a Dave Roberts when the Dodgers are expected to be good and they're really, really good, and he wins it almost by default. But generally speaking, it's one of those two things. Either a team that started poorly and really turns it on, or a team that had low expectations and really exceeds those expectations. So because the Cardinals' expectations for next season will be a little bit lower than what they have been in recent years, who knows? Maybe this time next year we are discussing Oliver Marmol as being one of the finalists and maybe even winning. You never know. All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk some Blues hockey. Robert Thomas back on the ice tonight. We'll discuss that in just a moment here on KMOX. Back at it on KMOX. It's Graybar Sports Open Line. As we shift gears talking baseball to talking hockey, the Blues are back at it this evening. And not only are they back at it, they've got a guy back on the ice. Robert Thomas has returned after missing just 12 games with a fractured right ankle. That's crazy, by the way. That is absolutely crazy. He gets his ankle fractured on a slap shot that gets him right in the right spot. Nothing you can really do about it. And the timeline that was given at the time was 4 to 6 weeks. And everybody kind of scoffed at that and said, this is more of a 6 to 8 week injury. Or, you know, was that the one where they said he would be reevaluated in 8 weeks? I feel like maybe that's how they even termed it, or in 6 weeks. I feel like that's maybe the way they, anyways, he's back. He's back on the ice tonight after missing 12 games in less than a month. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. Drew Bannister spoke with the media earlier today, as did Robert Thomas. We'll listen to a little bit from both these guys. And Bannister explained how Thomas was able to get back so quickly.
Since we went on the road, I think it was going to be a day-to-day thing at that point. We saw a lot of good progress with him on the ice and how he was feeling. Yesterday he came in at a great skate, talked to the doctors, and he feels comfortable. The doctors are comfortable with it, and he's ready to go.
Seems remarkable. Is that just a combination of the will of the player, the effort of the player, and then medical stuff?
Yeah. I mean, certainly, like, he's put in a lot of work to get to this point. Doesn't look like he's missed a beat. Like, he's in great shape. Obviously, he went away for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks to do some work in Toronto with his doctors there, and I think that really sped up the process. When I think we initially talked about it was 4 to 6 weeks, and we're a day earlier that 4 weeks. So, but it says a lot about the player and the work that he's put in and the willingness to get back and want to be back in the lineup for us.
Thomas also spoke on how he was able to get back so quickly.
Yeah, it's obviously frustrating being out, but I invested a lot in myself and pretty happy with the result and getting back so soon. So, excited to be back in the lineup and looking forward to getting in the trenches with the guys.
Also talk about, when Thomas felt like that there was actually the possibility that he could return after just such a short time being out.
Just a day-by-day approach. Started to feel better the last couple of days skating and, got to a point where, comfortable for everyone that I was ready to go. So pretty much just the last, week or so, wasn't planning on the road trip, but just wanted to be around the guys and take it day by day. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, he mentions the comfort in playing. If you're going to put him back out on the ice, you want to make sure that he's not compromised, where there's more of a chance or a higher percentage chance that he could exacerbate the injury or re-injure it. He said that after talking through with the medical team, that he's very comfortable playing, and went on a little bit more just talking through kind of the medical side of this decision.
obviously things can happen, but it's at a level where you know, both me and the doctors are comfortable, and you know, that's the main thing.
Was avoiding any kind of surgery too paramount and all this too? I mean,
yeah, I mean, the last thing you ever want to do is get surgery, so that's definitely wasn't an option for me.
What did rehab actually look like for you? Like on a, when you're able to start doing things, what were you able to do to help heal it?
Yeah, a bunch of things. You know, you try as many things as you can possible. There's obviously a ton of new technology that can potentially help you heal, and you know, we'll keep that one behind the doors. But you try and do everything you can. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, that's so. We don't know what he did to go through rehab, saying he's going to keep some of that behind closed doors. But he was able to work with doctors and work with technology to be able to return very, very quickly. So now that brings up how he will be used. Mentioned earlier on the show, he's going to be back on the top line, centering Buchnevich and Kyrou. He's also going to run the power play from the point, something that's a little bit new for him from an NHL standpoint. So that's how he's going to be. That's going to be how he's used. And Bannister went through all of that and what it's going to look like.
One, you know, and they've had a lot of success together. Obviously, you know, we want to start creating more, a little bit more offense, or creating our opportunities and being able to finish on them. I think it's something that he's going to be comfortable with, and Bucci too, to get those guys going. And I think it's just a good opportunity for them to get going here.
Thoughts on using him on the point of the power play?
Yeah, it's just a little bit of an adjustment that we're going to make, and I think you're going to see a lot more movement up top, and he probably won't end up there all the time, but there's going to be a little bit more movement, but he'll start there.
Have you discussed using him there as part of a five forward unit?
Yep. Yeah, we've talked about five forwards, but we like Flack there too, just to have the stability and the shot on that one flank.
So a couple things there. Let's start with his usage on the top line, where Buchnevich is going to move back out to the wing, and Kyrou is going to be out there as well. And you feel like this team has the opportunity to get the most out of Buchnevich, at least right now, working from a winger spot on that top line. And Thomas clearly is happy to be back with those guys and thinks very highly of his line mates.
You know, just watching the last couple games, I think those two have been playing really well. They've been creating turnovers. They've been getting lots of chances. Passing game, it looked like Ruzzi hit the post like four times in four shifts. And, you know, those are going to start going in for him. And I think just speed, being all over the puck, supporting each other, being confident and making plays. You know, that's part of our game when we're at our best. And that's something I'm hoping to bring to them.
And then the other side of that is running the power play from the point. He discussed that and when the last time he really did that was.
It's something I haven't done in a little while. I like the way we moved out there. I thought we created a lot of good chances, and you know, I'm excited to try it in the game.
So have you done it before?
Yeah, I played it in junior, but not since then.
Yeah, last time he did it was junior hockey. So, but still, I don't think anybody's too worried about him being able to go out there and do that. But he's going to be asked to do a lot. Obviously, top line, being on the power play as well. First game back, coming back really early. And I think it was a legitimate question. Bannister was asked whether or not there's going to be a minutes restriction for Thomas tonight.
That's something that I'll talk with Tom around the bench a little bit. And we've talked to each other here before the morning skate. And we'll manage that and see how he's feeling. But I think his legs are there. Like I said, he's done an incredible job keeping himself in real good shape right now, and he's skated himself hard, so it's something we're going to have to watch, but I'll talk to him during game.
A lot was made of him going on this last road trip, and I think rightfully so, because that was the thing that kind of signaled, okay, this guy is pretty close to being able to return. So being on the road, he got an up-close view of what was going on with the team, a trip that saw them lose a game in overtime, win a game in overtime, and then just lose a game flat out as well. He was asked about how he feels like the team has played in his absence.
I think the last three games, they've been close games. Even Carolina, the 4-1 game, didn't feel like it watching. That Neck has played a good game, and but you know, we're right in every game. Everyone's battling. They're tight games, and you know, hopefully I can help bring them over the hump.
So he says that he hopes to bring them over the hump, and you've been out for a while. I think the obvious thing is that you want to do as much as you can, and sometimes that turns into doing too much or trying too hard or items like that. And Thomas said that he's going to go out there and try to remain in himself and not do too much here in his first game back.
Being the guy that you know you can be, that's pretty much it. You can't get too complicated, too fancy early. You got to get back into the rhythm of the game, and it's tough being out for so long. Today was my first real practice with the guys, so it's going to take a little bit, but keeping it simple early will be important.
So Robert Thomas back tonight. One other Blues thing really quickly. Jordan Binnington's going to be in goal tonight. I think we can mostly agree that Binnington, even Hofer, they've done a pretty good job. They've been left out to dry at times by everybody in front of them. The numbers don't look great. Numbers don't look great for either of those goaltenders. Bannister was asked about that today, and I thought his answer was really interesting about how well or how not well that the goaltenders have played for the Blues this year.
Yeah, I think if you look around the league, the numbers on all goalies are down. You know, so I don't think it is an instance just with them. I think the goaltending numbers have gone down across the league. You know, and I think both of them have played some real good hockey. Are they, you know, at the level where we saw them at the end of last year? Probably not, but they're pretty close, you know. And I think as a team, we got to be better in front of them too. You know, we got to do our part. And but you know, they're two great goalies. You know, we're very lucky to have these two guys. And you know, like I said, I think as a team, we have to be better in front of them.
Thought that was a really interesting answer from Drew Bannister, and it kind of confirmed it. If you listen to me a lot, you know that I'm not an eye test over what the numbers say guy. That's a lot of times I think, you know, especially in large sample sizes, I tend to look more towards the numbers. But I agree with Bannister there. I think the Blues goaltending duo has performed much better than the numbers would indicate. And a lot of those negative numbers I would blame on the guys in front of them and not so much those two individuals. One more break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up hour number one of the program. This is a Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Back at it. We've had a lot to talk about here in hour number one of the program. Went through everything going on with the Blues. They're going to get started over at the Enterprise Center in just a little while. They match up against the Minnesota Wild tonight. And let's all hope that the return of Robert Thomas is the start of something really good for this team. And we'll see. We'll talk about that a little bit more coming up on the program tomorrow. And the Cardinals and what, you know, there continues to be so much focus on what the 2025 Cardinals might look like. And not that the 40-man roster moves today tell us that much, but they tell us a little. And I think we start to get some ideas of who might get some opportunities come next year. Again, we talked about this when we went through it. If it came down to, and I don't know if it came down to this or not, it just feels like when they were looking at the 40-man roster spots and say they were willing to utilize one roster spot for a relief pitcher potentially, Svanson versus Bedell, they go with Svanson. Does that tell you that they are getting set for him to possibly have an opportunity this upcoming season? And I think especially from a relief pitching standpoint, you're not putting these guys on the 40-man roster if you don't feel like they've got the ability to help the major league roster right now. And that's going to be an area. They may trade Ryan Helsley. It seems unlikely that Andrew Kittredge is going to return. Who knows who's going to be the closer? Right now, I think Ryan Fernandez probably has the inside track for that job, although I would guess that's going to be a closer by committee where him and JoJo Romero and Matthew Liberatore would be the guys, assuming that Helsley is gone. But there's going to be opportunities for relief pitchers next year. So if you're Svanson, you feel really, really good about the decision that the Cardinals made today. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Back at it as we roll on. It's the Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. Matt Pauley with you, taking you till 8 o'clock this hour. We've got a jam-packed hour. Jay Jaffe is going to join us in 10-15 minutes. We'll get his thoughts on the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame ballot that came out yesterday and who he thinks is going to get in. I think there's three names that I feel very comfortable are likely to get in. And beyond that, who might we see get in this year and who might have a path to eventually getting in as well? I keep going back to the path that Scott Rolen took, where he barely had enough votes to even stay on the ballot. And eventually, year after year, it continues to grow. And he eventually gets in. And I, by the way, I think that's a credit to the voters. Like, it's really easy to take shots at the baseball writers and the voters. And sometimes they're very deserving of those shots that we take. But I think when you see a guy steadily get more and more votes, I do think that the voters are considering other things and listening to the arguments and things like that. And there is value in that. I've always believed, you know, you don't host a sports show like this without really believing in the things that you say. And that's what I do. I'm a big believer of you have to defend the words that come out of your mouth. But at the same time, I think sometimes people in this industry don't leave open the possibility for being wrong and don't leave open the possibility for taking in other information and adjusting their take on something. And that's, I always try not to be that way. As strongly as I might believe in something, I always try to have a very open mind about things and listen to what other people say and be willing to change my opinion on it. I know I don't get everything right. So I think it's a credit to baseball writers when there is somebody who starts off with not so many votes and slowly but surely makes their way in. So who of the new entrants might be on that list? And we'll talk with Jay Jaffe about that. And then later on this hour, it's our weekly conversation with Patrick Mahomes that we get courtesy of our sister station in Kansas City, 96.5 The Fan. So the Chiefs quarterback will be on coming up in just a little while. New college football playoff rankings just being released within the last 15, 20 minutes or so. In previous years, nothing of consequence would have happened because there was no changes in the top five spots. Now that changes a little bit because now with the expanded playoff, what happens down below ends up mattering. So the top five spots are still Oregon, Ohio State, Texas, Penn State, Indiana. Tom Ackerman's Indiana Hoosiers are in that five spot. Notre Dame has moved up two spots to number six. Alabama moves up three spots to number seven. Miami back up one spot to number eight. Ole Miss up two spots to number nine. Georgia up two spots to number 10. Tennessee drops four spots to number 11. Boise State goes up one spot to number 12. That is notable, by the way. That's really notable that Boise State is in the 12 spot. Then you have SMU at 13 and BYU. They drop eight spots. This is what happens when you lose to Kansas. They drop eight spots and they go all the way to number 14. The reason Boise being at number 12 is notable for all this is because with Boise State being ahead of BYU, you have a group of five leader ahead of one of the Power Four conference leaders. So the top-ranked Big 12 team is BYU, but Boise State is in front of BYU. So that puts the Broncos in position to get a first-round bye. I wasn't planning on talking about it, but I'm going to. This is the one issue I take with the college football playoff rankings. If the regular season ended right now, number 12 Boise State would get a first round bye. That's dumb. That's dumb. That's really dumb. And I get the idea that you want to award conference champions, that there needs to be a carrot out there, that if you win a conference championship, you get something extra beyond just being seeded. I don't like it. Like, that would be the equivalent. This is not an apples to apples, but that would be the equivalent of some of these low level conference champions in college basketball getting seeded higher than a really good power conference second place team or a really good power conference third place team. Like, that's just silly. It doesn't make sense. So if you win a conference championship in college basketball, you get into the big dance, but your seeding is not guaranteed. And if you come from a not very good conference, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to be a 15 seed or a 16 seed, something like that. It bothers me that they've got this set up where basically the rules are the four conference champions get a first round bye. However, if one of the group of five conference champions has a higher ranking in the college football playoff rankings than one of the power conference champions, well, then that team gets the first round bye instead. That's just, it's dumb. Like, I would have no problem saying that, because right now, BYU isn't even in the top 12. So I don't have a problem if the Big 12 is guaranteed a spot into the college football playoff. That if BYU or Utah or Kansas State or whoever ends up playing Colorado, whoever ends up winning the Big 12 championship this year, I have no, Iowa State is still probably in the running in that for as well. I have no problem with, no matter who wins the conference championship game, getting an automatic entry into the college football playoff. That makes all the sense in the world to me. You win your conference championship game, you get in. But to give the first round bye and then to have this situation where a Boise State at number 12 would be in line for a first round bye, and this type of situation won't happen very often. More often than not, the champion, the top ranked team from the SEC, from the Big Ten, from the ACC and Big 12, you would think more often than not, those programs are maybe not all top four where you would think that they get the first round bye, but all top seven, top eight, top nine type teams. But it's not like that right now, and it puts them in a weird situation. Locally, Missouri and Illinois each stay in, or Missouri stays in, Illinois back in. Missouri is at number 23. That's where they were at last week. That's notable because they fell out of both the AP poll and the coaches poll. And then Illinois, they move back in at 7-3. They come in at number 25 after they were dominant against Michigan State this past weekend. We didn't talk a lot about the Illinois-Michigan State game. There was so much focus on the Mizzou game and what happened against South Carolina. We haven't spent much time talking about what Illinois did this past weekend. That was a really good win for them. And I don't know if it's a statement win, but it's certainly a notable win for them. So that's kind of the idea of what's going on right now with the college football playoff rankings, which are just released. Jay Jaffe joins us in just a moment. We'll get his thoughts on the Baseball Hall of Fame ballot that was released yesterday. We'll do that next here on KMOX. Gray Bar Sports Open Line here on KMOX, your home for the Cardinals. Yesterday, the Major League Baseball, not Major League Baseball, but the Baseball Hall of Fame ballot came out, being released by the Baseball Hall of Fame, as a lot of new names are on there, some holdovers as well. There's nobody in the world better to talk about that with than a guy who wrote the Cooperstown Casebook, and he is the creator of JAWS, which is a way that you can evaluate players. He is our friend Jay Jaffe, senior writer at Fangraphs. Follow him on Twitter at J_JAFFE. Jay, always appreciate you taking some time with us today. How are you?
Hey, thanks. Good to be back.
So you look at the names that are on this list. Am I correct in saying that Ichiro Suzuki, CC Sabathia are pretty much for sure first ballot Hall of Famers, and in all likelihood we'll see a guy who got very close last year in Billy Wagner. Those three, is it a safe bet that those three are probably going to get in this time?
I think probably short of a safe bet on CC. I think CC Sabathia is going to be a Hall of Famer someday, and someday in the next few years. I don't think it's going to be an automatic first ballot entry. I think he could get in, but I think it's more likely he builds toward a year two or year three entry. I think he's going to take a little bit of convincing for some people, but I'll be pleasantly surprised if I'm wrong and he does get in. I'm certainly in favor of it.
Is the pushback on CC just there's many voters out there that are more restrictive on their first-year ballots?
I think that's part of it. I think also maybe there's some, unfortunately, we've seen as the way the role of the starting pitcher has changed over the last 50 years, really, we've seen declines in workload. We've seen, higher ERAs, especially from the era that Sabathia played. I mean, his career ERA is 3.74, which would be one of the highest in the Hall of Fame. But it takes some interpretation. You have to, you could put that in perspective by understanding, the high-scoring ballparks he was in, like Yankee Stadium and things like that. It just takes a little bit more finesse to make his case because, he's he didn't win 300 games. He's only 251 games. He did strike out 3,000 batters, only the third lefty to do that. Has won Cy Young, has one World Series ring, good postseason resume. But, you know, his last few years were a bit of a grind. And sometimes I think it's a little hard to overcome that that recent memory as well. But, I'm optimistic in the long run. I just don't think it's going to be as easy as Ichiro, who I expect to be, getting almost unanimous, if not completely unanimous support.
In terms of Billy Wagner, he got so close last year. What happens when somebody gets that close? What kind of conversations happen in the 10, 11 months between the announcement and when the next voting takes place, where there's going to be obviously a lot of voters who do put Wagner probably on their ballot this time?
Yeah, I think that, I think there are there's certainly a segment of voters likes to be the one that finally kind of close ranks around a guy and say, yeah, I helped get him in. I'm the gatekeeper here. I'm once I approve, he's a Hall of Famer. But there's also, new voters coming into this who are maybe a little bit more attuned to, being for a given candidate than the voters they're replacing who've aged out of the electorate. There's people who maybe didn't have him on their ballots for space reasons the last couple of years. I think there are any one of a number of reasons. It's a body of almost 400 voters, and they all have their individual reasons for how do they come to their decisions. Wagner wasn't a slam dunk. At one point, he was only getting about 10% or so of the support. So this has really been a long, slow build. But there is some urgency to his candidacy now because he's in his final year, and he fell just 5 votes short last year. There was one very conspicuous drop from the ballot by a guy who wrote a whole column about it, then a whole column about how he was being bullied on social media for making the choice. There's all kinds of weird stuff happens here, but I do think he'll get in. And I think there are people looking at his credentials. And, as we watch the next generation of potential Hall of Fame closers, guys like Craig Kimbrell and Kenley Jansen and Aroldis Chapman scuffle in their mid-30s and maybe look like they're not going to make it. I think we can appreciate a little bit more just how close Billy Wagner is and how worthy he is of election.
Other holdovers include Alex Rodriguez, Manny Ramirez, Andrew Jones, Carlos Beltran, Chase Utley, Omar Vizquel, Jimmy Rollins, Bobby Abreu, Andy Pettit, Mark Burley, Francisco Rodriguez, Torrey Hunter, David Wright. Look, some of those guys obviously have some other things going on. Some of those guys are connected to PD. Some of those guys are connected to other things like Carlos Beltran. Is there anybody on that list that to you clearly is going to get kind of on that track? You mentioned a Wagner starting with 10% of the votes here in St. Louis. We know about the path that Scott Rowland took. Any of those holdovers do you feel like still has that path to get in?
Yeah, I think Utley is a guy I look at as having kind of a Scott Rowland path. I mean, modest early support. Utley, as I pointed out in my FanGraphs chat today, Utley actually debuted with 28.8% of the vote. That's much higher than Rowland or Larry Walker, a little bit higher than Tim Raines, a little bit higher than Mike Messina. And I'm sure I'm forgetting one or two of these guys, but we've seen a whole bunch of candidates in recent years rally back from getting these low shares to gain entry, usually late in their candidacy, sometimes even in their final year, like Raines and Walker and Edgar Martinez, who I think debuted a little bit higher than 28. But that's who I hold out hope for from that bracket. And closer to the mark, Carlos Beltran has the third highest share of any returning candidate. And really, I think is on progress towards eventual election. I think we saw some of the resistance to him was maybe first year resistance. It's a kind of a slap on the wrist for his participation in the Astro sign stealing scandal, but he still has about 18 points to make up. So it's probably a 2 or 3 year away type thing. And Andrew Jones is even closer than that, although he's now in his 8th year and with 61.6% of the vote last year. And he's got, some issues. I mean, kind of a lopsided career, did everything in his teens and 20s, Not much of a career in his 30s in terms of value. And unfortunately, the way his career ended, after his career ended in the majors in his mid-30s, he had a domestic violence charge against him, and that I think has maybe taken some of the fun out of this. But that hasn't entirely impeded his progress. And I think those are the ones that I look at from this. I don't think the PED guys are getting anywhere. They actually both lost about a point of support last year. We're talking A-Rod and Manny. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Andy Pettit lost support too, but he's much lower down. So, I think there's a lot of interest in the new guys, though.
Yeah, kind of the same same question on that. And for people who weren't paying attention over the last couple of days, Felix Hernandez, Carlos Gonzalez, Dustin Pedroia, Hanley Ramirez, Fernando Rodney, Ian Kinsler, Ben Zobrist, Troy Tulowitzki, Russell Martin, Brian McCann, Curtis Granderson, Adam Jones. Who do you feel like, same question, who maybe doesn't get in this year, maybe has that low number this year, but does see a path to Cooperstown?
Yeah, I don't know if any of those guys are going to see a path to Cooperstown, but I really want to talk about Russell Martin and Brian McCann because we've placed such a high value on pitch framing. We've learned about how valuable it is over the past decade and a half. And once you incorporate that into the statistics of McCann and Martin, you see that because they were better hitters than, say, Yadier Molina, not to press a point too hard here, their career values were on par with Molina. And I know we talk a lot about Molina as a potential Hall of Famer, and I think it really comes from the quantification, at least in part, has to do with his pitch framing. And so if you're going to tell me Yadier Molina is a Hall of Famer, I'm going to tell you that I think he is too, but I also think that Russell Martin and Brian McCann are probably worthy of that honor as well. And down the road, Buster Posey as well. And, I want to make sure that we understand this, the terms of the debate here when it comes to quantifying at least some of these catchers' contributions.
Yeah, no, I think it's because you're right. You're 100% right. And just about everybody listening to you in St. Louis is going to tell you that Yadier Molina absolutely is a Hall of Famer. And I agree with that. But as I was having conversations about this the other day, I was talking about it more in terms of Brian McCann than Russell Martin, to be perfectly honest with you. But I can see a case for McCann. I think you make an interesting point on Martin as well on why these guys might have a path to Cooperstown.
Yeah, McCann won a World Series. He was on that Astros team that won in 2017. And, I think we all, you're entitled to feel icky about that if you want to. I know I certainly do. But, he was a part of several playoff teams, always sought by good teams. Excellent hitter when he was healthy. Russell Martin was a transformative player at two of his stops. Both the Pirates and Blue Jays had like epic playoff droughts before he got there. And he really did a lot to help those pitching staffs and, was a good hitter as well. Martin was one of my favorite players to watch. I grew up a Dodgers fan, so I kind of default to watching the Dodgers when I have, no other pressing viewing appointments for baseball. And Martin, I just could never take my eyes off the guy. He was so mobile behind the plate, great at pitch blocking, excellent, as we later learned, at pitch framing. Saw him here in New York with the Yankees, saw what he did in Pittsburgh and Toronto, and that's all well documented. And he really was a transformative player. And I think that I'm looking forward to making the case. I don't even know if he's going to be on the next ballot. I hope I drum up enough support to keep him around. And there's other guys here. I don't think Dustin Pedroia or Ian Kinsler or Felix Hernandez has a very strong shot of getting in while they're on the writer's ballot. But these guys had some great careers and certainly some fantastic moments. Pedroia was probably on a Hall of Fame path before his knee injury. Just didn't have the longevity that puts him in the camp of literally hundreds of other players. We can lament that they fell short, and I don't mean to keep making short jokes about Pedroia. I'm not exactly known for my ability to dunk a basketball myself here. So But Felix Hernandez, you know, I think if he'd maybe won another Cy Young Award and stayed in better shape and got some longevity, he would definitely be in the conversation. I mean, you know, pitcher wins are not a great proxy for the Hall conversation anymore. He finished with 169 wins. If he'd gotten to 200, I think he'd be getting in almost regardless. He was so good at his peak. His peak just didn't last long enough. He just didn't hold together long enough. And I think part of that was overuse, and part of that was maybe lackluster conditioning. And I wish it had been different, but that's where we are.
Jay Jaffe, senior writer, Fangraphs, author of the Cooperstown Casebook. Jay, appreciate you taking time with us. I'm sure we'll talk to you again come around induction time and get your thoughts on what ends up happening.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks a lot.
Very good. That is Jay Jaffe. This is Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
We're back out on the Graybar Sports Open Line here on KMOX. We are your home for Chiefs football. And this past weekend, well, the Chiefs, they lose for the first time this year as they match up against Buffalo and fall to the Bills in Buffalo by a 30-21 score. Feels like there's a pretty good chance these two teams could meet each other again in the postseason. Who knows? This might be an AFC Championship preview. You look at these two teams, you look at Baltimore, you look at Pittsburgh, really is the top teams in the AFC. There's some other teams in there. We're talking yesterday on the show about the Chargers and how they probably are going to be a fairly tough out. The Texans have looked good at times. I don't know. It still feels like maybe they're a step behind some of these other teams. But Bills, Chiefs, to many, feel like the top two teams in the AFC. And for the first time this year, the Chiefs do end up losing a game. They're trying to put together some more pieces and do some other things in order to just be where they want to be. I mean, it's an offense that doesn't have all the pieces that they would like to have due to injury and some other things. But at the end of the day, I think most people feel pretty good about where Kansas City is going to be when all is said and done, but coming off a loss, as is the case each week. We get to hear from Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes, an exclusive interview he does with our sister station in Kansas City, 96.5 The Fan, as he talks with our colleague Carrington Harrison on an every week basis. As they opened up their conversation this week, they talked a little bit about the atmosphere and what it was like playing in Buffalo this past weekend.
The crowd was definitely live out there. Obviously, I think the postseason was a little bit rowdier just because, I mean, it's a playoff football game. That's kind of how it is at every stadium. But they packed it out, man. It was a hostile environment for sure.
You're a history, you know, buff when it comes to the game and a story, and so to speak. What is it like to be in the middle of one of those kind of, you know, Colts and Patriots kind of rivalries where, you know, every time you guys play Buffalo, there's big stakes on board, and you know it's always going to be a tightly contested game going into the fourth quarter?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely cool. I mean, to be able to be in one of those games where it means a ton for seeding and everything like that as far as playoffs and stuff like that. But it's just cool going up against the best of the best. And we've been able to play Buffalo these last few years, and it's been a lot of fun. Obviously, we've won some and lost some.
You guys obviously never want to lose, but in some ways, is there a relief to kind of not have to talk about being undefeated every week? Like, that conversation was really going to ramp up if you guys had won this game. That now it's about the things that really matter, taking care of business in the AFC West, locking up a one seed, and putting you guys in the best position to go back to another Super Bowl.
Either way. I mean, I don't think it wasn't too much of a distraction or anything like that. I think we were just going about it one week at a time, and obviously, there won't be no questions at all because we have the loss. So I guess that could be a good thing. But at the same time, we have to focus on just getting better every week and trying to play our best football as the season goes on.
What was the tone around the team? You know, it's been a while since you guys have had a regular season loss, a loss period. You know, we're talking about almost going on a calendar year. For some of the guys on the team, that's the first time they've lost in their NFL career. What was kind of the tone for the team after the game? And how do you get those guys refocused as you head into another week and another week of practice?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you don't want to ever lose. So, I mean, guys weren't happy. But at the same time, I think guys understand that we have to be better. We have to execute the details better and play better football if we want to continue to stack up wins. It's about learning from this experience. I mean, obviously, You don't want to lose any more games or anything like that, but you have to get better each and every week, and I think that's something that we can do following this loss.
Is that tone set by the coaches? Is that tone set by someone like you, Travis, Chris, guys that have kind of been through the ups and downs of a season? Obviously, you want to keep things in a perspective. You guys are still 9-1 and still in line to do all of those things, but that message this week, is that coming more from the players or is that coming more from the coaches?
I think it comes from everybody. I mean, that's what makes us such a great team, is the coaches hold themselves accountable just like the players hold themselves accountable, and it kind of goes throughout the entire building. So we make sure that we just get to practice and we continue to work and get better. But, I mean the coaches emphasize it. We emphasize it as players, and then we go out there and execute whenever game day comes.
Right now we're talking to the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes. Patrick, let's talk about some things that happened in the game. There was some good and bad from Xavier Worthy, in my opinion. Let's talk about the drive that he had. That, to me, kind of felt like a man, everything is starting to click moment. He finished with 4 catches for 61 yards. I thought Xavier Worthy played as well as he's played in about a couple of months or so.
Yeah, I think you see his confidence. He has a better understanding for the entire offense, and when he got in some man type situations, he was winning and getting himself open. So I mean, he's going to continue to get better and better. I mean, he's still a young kid. I mean, he's 21 years old and out here in the NFL getting a high volume of snaps, and he's making plays when he's getting opportunities. And so, like I said after the game, we have to continue to get him more and more involved in the offense throughout the entire game. But I thought he had a good game, all things considering.
Take us through the deep pass play that resulted in an incompletion. What we kind of talked about on the show was, sure, you could probably make a better throw in that scenario, put the ball in a better spot to help lead to a touchdown, but I also don't think that that play should result in an incompletion either. Just kind of take us through that balance and how you guys can kind of help him get just some better field awareness, in my mind.
I think more than anything, it was kind of a play that you just have to learn from in general for me and for him. I mean, I think that wasn't necessarily the first read of the play, but I just, how the safety reacted to the run fake, I knew that he was going to have some free room over there, and didn't fully see him, but try to put it out there for him to make a play. And wish I could have kind of set my feet, seen him, and just thrown a ball where he can lead him upfield, where he can score a touchdown. But I think just more and more reps that we get with that play, then those type throws will just continue to get better. And I know everybody hates it. It's kind of happened a couple of times this year, but at the same time, I feel like we're getting closer and closer, and you want to be able to hit those as the playoffs come around and into the rest of his career.
That's sort of how it feels to me. You know, you guys have kind of had one of those moments in each of the last game, you know, against Tampa Bay, against the Broncos, and against Buffalo. It does feel like as we get closer to the postseason, when you really want to get this thing right, it does feel like you guys are on track to getting that part of your game figured out.
Yeah, and I think it's shown over time, man. As you continue to get more and more reps, you get a feel for how the guy runs routes. You get a feel for he gets a feel for how I want him to be in certain spots at certain timings. And I think he's getting more confident and being able to be himself. And I think whenever you're playing and not thinking is when you can play your best. And I think he's getting to that point.
Right now, we're talking to the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes. How good is it to get Juju Smith-Schuster back? It feels like just with Pacheco coming back to practice, Aminahu coming back to practice, Juju playing on Sunday against Buffalo, it feels like you guys are kind of coming out on the other side of some of the bad injury luck you guys had in the first half of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to get those guys back, man. They worked their tail off, and so I'm excited to start getting some of those guys back on the field and letting them get back to being the special players that they are. And it was good to have Juju out there, man, someone I have a lot of confidence in. And I think as we continue to get more and more guys back, we'll continue to be better, especially offensively, and be able to go out there and execute at a higher level. And I'm just excited for what we have in store for these last few weeks going into the postseason.
I'm not sure if Pacheco's going to play at this game, but I do think he plays before the end of the month, either in this game against Carolina or against the Raiders. What is it going to be like to get him back, and how do you incorporate both backs into the system, as Kareem Hunt has also had a lot of success?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a special group, man. I mean, to be able to have Kareem and how he's playing and how he's running the ball, getting those extra yards, and then adding Pop, who we know is going to be excitement, and he's going to have energy, and he's going to make big plays happen and run tough. I think it's going to be hard for defenses to account for, and as well as you get the run game going, it opens up the pass game as well. And so I'm excited for it, man. I'm excited to get guys healthy, get them back in the swing of things, and let them go out there and be the special players that they are.
I know you've broken down the film. What do you think Buffalo did against Travis Kelce that gave them so much success?
All honesty, man, they did what they always do. I mean, they just played at a high intensity, a high level, and really focused in on trying to take away what you're good at, and they did a good job of that. I got to be better at getting him involved early and getting him some throws. Even on the first interception, I probably could have just fit the ball into Trav and get the first down. And so, I mean, just stuff like that to get him going and get him involved in the offense. And, I mean, that's how some games roll, and other guys stepped up and made plays like Noah and Xavier, but getting those main guys going will help out the entire offense.
I was just going to ask you about Noah. He had two touchdowns in this game. He's really been a good piece for you guys. How have you seen his game grow over the years as you and him build rapport and continue to build on that chemistry?
Yeah, I think it's just me having confidence in him. As I watch film, it seems like every year when I do our scheme evaluation, I look at the film and I'm just like, man, if I just give Noah some of those opportunities, he's open a lot of the times during the game. And even in this last game, I threw a ball to Trav in the early second half where Noah kind of breaks open late. And that's not necessarily the first read, but it's one that I can alert and get to if I like the matchup. And so just continue to give him more and more opportunities to make plays. He's a guy that's going to do everything it takes to win the football game, and you want those guys on your team.
You guys' final touchdown drive, I think that was the best drive that you guys have had this season. You guys never faced a third down. You went down the field. As you watch the film, how is that something you guys can continue to replicate to get this offense firing on all cylinders?
Yeah, I think it's just having the urgency that we have on those final drives throughout the entire game. I mean, it seems like whenever we get down into a spot where we have to score a touchdown, we go out there and score a touchdown. And I think if we can have that urgency and that sense of I don't want to say pressure, but that sense of I got to do this right now every single drive, then we'll be a hard football team to beat. And it's about learning how to do that and maintaining that throughout an entire football game.
How do you guys keep that urgency against this opponent? I mean, this game is sandwiched in between some pretty big games. You know, you go on the road against Buffalo. You got Black Friday coming up at home against a divisional opponent, a hated rival in the Raiders. How do you guys keep that intensity up on the road against in Carolina?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you turn on the tape and you see these, especially these last 2 weeks, this team's playing good football. I'm not going to say that they started off the year they wanted the way they wanted to, but they've gotten healthier. Their quarterback's playing good football, and their defense is playing really good these last few weeks. And so they had a bye week. They're going to be confident. We're going to have to go down there and play at their place, and they're going to give us everything they have. And so it's going to be a great game, man. And I'm not going to let the record fool me. I know this team has a lot of great football players, and it's going to take our best football to go out there and get a win.
Patrick, this is your first time playing against the Panthers on the road. Is this your first time in Charlotte? You know, that's not a Major League Baseball city. You know, maybe you had win with your pops before. This is your first time playing there. Are you even familiar with Charlotte?
I believe I've been there once. I can't remember exactly. I believe I've been there once on a golfing-type trip at some point a while back. But, I mean, I think it's a great city from everything I've heard. And they got a lot of young, talented players that are hungry, and it's going to be a great football game.
I'll get you out of here with this. I would say that my two favorite college football players growing up were Reggie Bush and Cam Newton. Obviously, he's a great Panther. Who was that college football player for you growing up that you were just always going to be a huge fan of?
Cam's a good one. I think Cam's a good one just because I saw him play when he was at Blinn College against Tyler Junior College. They won like 70-7. So he's a good one that I always think about. Tim Tebow was a big one with just how good that Florida football team was. And then obviously the big one for me was Vince Young, just because being in Texas and playing USC in that Rose Bowl was a special moment for any Texas football fan.
I love Vince Young too, but you know he cost Reggie Bush that national championship. That moment always hurts me.
Yeah, I know, but that was good. That was good for me, you know, to see Vince go out there and dominate college football. And I mean, like, just like the hero type figure. I mean, the guy that could run, throw, do it all. Even before that was the thing.
That is Patrick Mahomes joining us on the show today, quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. They look to get back on their winning path against Carolina this weekend. Pat, man, I'm looking forward to talking Thanksgiving with you next week, man. I appreciate you.
Yep, good seeing you. 2 weeks, and so they had a bye week. They're going to be confident. We're going to have to go down there and play at their place, and they're going to give us everything they have. And so it's going to be a great game, man. And I'm not going to let the record fool me. I know this team has a lot of great football players, and it's going to take our best football to go out there and get a win.
Patrick, this is your first time playing against the Panthers on the road. Is this your first time in Charlotte? You know, that's not a Major League Baseball city. You know, maybe you had win with your pops before. This is your first time playing there. Are you even familiar with Charlotte?
I believe I've been there. I can't remember exactly. I believe I've been there once on a golfing type trip at some point a while back. But I mean, I think it's a great city from everything I've heard, and they got a lot of young, talented players that are hungry, and it's gonna be a great football game.
I'll get you out of here with this. I would say that my two favorite college football players growing up were Reggie Bush and Cam Newton. Obviously, he's a great Panther. Who was that college football player for you growing up that you were just always going to be a huge fan of?
Cam's a good one. I think Cam's a good one just because I saw him play when he was at Blinn College against Tyler Junior College. They won like 70-7. So he's a good one that I always think about. Tim Tebow was a big one with just how good that Florida football team was. And then obviously the big one for me was Vince Young, just because being in Texas and playing USC in that Rose Bowl was a special moment for any Texas football fan.
I love Vince Young too, but you know he cost Reggie Bush that national championship. That moment always hurts me.
Yeah, I know, but that was good. That was good for me, you know, to see Vince go out there and dominate college football. And I mean, like, just like the hero type figure. I mean, the guy that could run, throw, do it all, even before that was the thing.
That is Patrick Mahomes joining us on the show today, quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. They look to get back on their winning path against Carolina this weekend. Pat, man, I'm looking forward to talking Thanksgiving with you next week, man. I appreciate you.
Yep, good seeing you.
That is Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes talking with our guy Carrington Harrison in Kansas City on our sister station, 96.5 The Fan. Chiefs are getting ready for a matchup against the Panthers on the road. Man, if you're Carolina, this is not a game that you are looking forward to. You never like being that team facing off against a team, a really good team that has lost for the first time this year, and that's going to be the case. Let's see. I haven't even looked to see what the point spread for that game is. Right now, Kansas City is a 10.5-point favorite. It feels like the Chiefs could really put it on the Panthers this upcoming weekend. We'll have to wait and see how that's going to go. All right, that is it for the program today, but don't go anywhere because we've got the Gas House Gang coming your way after the 8 o'clock news. Today it is Tom Ackerman and Kevin Wheeler. They're going to be with you for Cardinals talk and a few other things as well. That's coming up in just a little bit, so don't go anywhere. The Gas House Gang on the way next. My name is Matt Pauley, back with you tomorrow at 6 o'clock for another Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX.